It's October 15th, 2023, and welcome to episode 270 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and the beginning of Unix time, I guess, or something along those lines. I am Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts today. Earl Evans, near Portland. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Paul. And I salute you at the beginning of the epoch.
Yes. Excellent. Thank you. Also joining us is Carrington Vanston from far from Portland, Oregon.
Everything is measured in distances from Portland from now on. New industry standard.
Excellent.
I appreciate that. Kind of.
It's presumably translatable into some number of smoots.
Right.
And also joining us is Quinn Dunkey, a British Columbian hick, is what her title says.
Yes. And I'm actually a medium distance from Portland, Oregon. I'm actually not that far either, so.
Almost striking distance.
Yeah.
Yeah, we basically have two Westies and two Easties.
Make of that what you will.
Fight? Wait, no.
Right. We concede!
Yeah. Let's try fighting a civil war the other way and see what happens. Let's go crossways this time.
Okay. So we have, over the past several episodes, been sort of tying the episode number to the year, and we have reached episode 270, which would correspond to the year 1970. And so we could maybe start by talking about some things about 1970.
I'm just going to say, I've been looking so forward to this. I knew that when we got to the 70s, it was going to get really exciting.
Because of disco.
Mainly, yeah.
Well, of course, disco and computing.
Yeah.
Because so much happened in computing in the 70s.
And we are starting to reach the time period where, like, many of us came to exist.
I already existed.
And might know a little bit about what we're talking
right.
about.
Oh, no, then I'm back out again.
Maybe a little anyway. Yeah. We'll be doing less of just reading the Wikipedia page on the show for the IBM 16 yeah. whatever.
Right.
Well, I was born a little earlier than y'all, but I was too young to know that there even were computers. You know, on TV, they were just some gigantic box in a room with lots of lights that blink. So I don't think I know any more about it.
Yeah, I was thinking the same. That, you know, I would have to reach some sort of critical consciousness age before it actually is relevant to my experience. But well, okay, so one thing that happened was that the I don't know that this was actually happened in 1970, but it was decided that January 1st, 1970 is, you know, the zero point for the Unix date stamp. So there we go. We have time has begun now.
And will end in 2038.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That created the 2038 problem, wherein we're going to run out of seconds in the 32-bit integer can no longer count seconds from January 1, 1970 in 2038. So we're going to have another Y2K problem, but this one potentially worse, because the Y2K problem was not as bad for the most part as people were worried about, but the 2038 problem could be pretty serious. I don't know.
Everybody's watches will crash.
I think there's a chance it'll be more serious because the Y2K problem didn't end up destroying a whole bunch of stuff. And the general public will go, there was no problem last time, so therefore there's no problem this time. The rock didn't fall right. on us. Let's ignore
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, and the Y2K problem wasn't a problem because actually a whole bunch of people worked real hard to fix a bunch of stuff. So that was sort of the system working. And so, yeah, the general public interpreted that as it was overblown. But in fact, actually, we just fixed it.
So, I mean, now people say, oh, they used to say there was a hole in the ozone. Well, there isn't now, so therefore there never was. It's like, no, people fixed it. We agreed yeah. on a thing.
Yeah, we did good.
They're like, oh, you're trying to convince me humans did something? Whatever.
Pascal was introduced in some way. It was published in 1970, according to Nicholas Wirth. We surely have some memories of Pascal.
Early Macintosh programming.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first high-level language I ever learned. We had a high school class on Pascal on the Olivetti's, That was, I guess, would have been Borland Pascal probably. And yeah, I enjoyed it. It's a good language. I still like it, actually.
It is a great language. We used it in university for the computer science concepts, which Pascal does particularly well, things like data structures. It has a really good handle on that. So I thought it was a great language to learn those things.
Yeah, I think it's a better first high-level language to learn, certainly than C is, because Pascal doesn't let you do as many stupid things as C does. You know, you see people, one of my friends is a professor of computer science, and you see in the code that the students write, because they learn C initially at this particular school, and C allows you to do things like just keep adding pointer dereferences and close brackets until it works. And you see the students doing that kind of stuff, which, like, Pascal doesn't let you do that stuff. It doesn't allow you to misunderstand things so much, and then also doesn't allow you to fudge your way out of it when you don't understand.
Yeah, right. When I was, you know, in college, that was the language they taught you in, you know, the CS classes too. So it was considered appropriate for student consumption.
I think that hurt it in a sense, because I remember Pascal really being talked about as like an academic language, blah, blah, blah. It's good for schools. I think it got a bad rep because of that. So I spent a lot of time reading Inside Macintosh books with a whole bunch of Pascal in them.
That's exactly where almost all of my Pascal comes from is those Inside Macintosh books. Even if I was writing in C, you know, you have to know the Pascal structure.
Yeah, that's right. Early Mac programming. It's funny, we all knew some Pascal because the Apple APIs were all written for Pascal. So I was using ThinkC during those years. But yeah, you had to learn how to like read a Pascal function declaration because that's how the APIs were documented. And you had to like work with Pascal strings in C, which was sort of hilarious. Everything was a Pascal string.
Well, it's funny to work with strings in C, period. C is like strings. You don't need strings. Strings are so overrated.
It's sort of an afterthought. Yeah. Here's a blob of memory. You're on your own. But yeah, it is funny how Pascal was sort of seen as less serious or something in industry. Like it was never taken as seriously. I don't know why exactly. I suspect that's a little bit of like ideological bias or something. Like C, the fact that it allowed you to do dirtier, lower level things more easily, maybe that got interpreted as being more serious and more hardcore than Pascal was. I guess it was also a little more efficient because you weren't compiling to P code. You were compiling to actual machine code, maybe. Maybe that was the difference. I don't know. I don't know why Pascal got a bad rap.
So on the Computer History Museum site, they have a little thing, you know, listing things that happened in 1970. And, you know, here's Pascal being introduced. Immediately after that is Shaky the Robot. Do you know Shaky the Robot?
I don't know. I went to Shakey's when I was a kid.
Right. Yeah, of course, that's the first association I have as well. But it's interesting, like, the degree to which it's if you sort of follow the links and stuff, it is promoted as being something that was groundbreaking in terms of, like, your self-driving cars and things today. But I had never heard of it prior to this mention in the Computer History Museum site, but Shaky the Robot was the first general-purpose mobile robot able to reason about its own actions, and it would, drive around mapping space and pushing blocks and things like this. Apparently the name...
Shaky just looks awesome.
Yeah.
Looks very robot-y. Like, that's a proper, like, 70s or 80s robot.
It's all
like
a stack of boxes, you know.
On top and some, well, you know... Yeah, some things going on the bottom there, and motors, and a camera, and oh my gosh, I want one of these.
Looks like many cameras.
I want a little reproduction of one of these. That would be so cool.
Yeah. So you can watch a little video of Shaky running around pushing boxes.
Oh, I wondered if there was that.
That's neat. I love how 80s robots all looked like garbage cans on wheels, kind of, with like stuff sticking out of them.
Yeah,
totally.
So if you... Like I hadn't heard of Shaky the Robot, you can read up on Shaky the Robot and learn how important it was, apparently. And all self-driving cars owe it a debt of some sort.
So was Shaky called Shaky because it would shake, or is that stands for something, initialism or something?
It's because it would shake. Because they were trying to come up with a name
now
for it.
I really
and,
like it.
they eventually, you know, someone just said, well, this thing shakes a lot. So anyway, so there's that. It's amusing, if nothing else.
These older videos about robotics are always fun because there's always an optimistic futurism to them. Like everyone assumed that, you know, they knew this was the beginning, robots like Shaky, but they assumed that this was, you know, imminently we were going to have stuff so much better than this. And then we really, like, robots today are pretty much still just Shaky. They're a little smoother and now they're white plastic instead of garbage cans, but they don't do a whole lot more than that, honestly. Turns out robotics is a lot harder than we thought it was going to be.
I think some of the things that I've seen from Boston Dynamics recently are pretty impressive. It seems like in the last few years, it's just jumped like a quantum leap from where it was.
Got from Shaky to terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
Dogs, it's a lot more scary now.
Freaked me out, man.
Yeah, progress has definitely accelerated. I think the main barrier now is still the power problem. Like the Boston Dynamics stuff is always tethered because there's still no way to get a portable power source that can last for more than 5 seconds doing the kind of stuff that they're doing. But yeah, if we ever get some sort of magic battery that can power one of those Boston Dynamics robots untethered, then yeah, I for one welcome our new big dog robot overlords.
They are definitely just playing on the terrifying robots idea, even though they don't claim to. But
the implication is always that we're 5 years away from robots living in our houses and possibly being our soldiers or whatever. But yeah, no, here we are 50 years later, garbage cans on wheels. But now they push boxes around in Amazon warehouses instead of red cubes in labs.
We had a robot at Hughes Aircraft that carried things around from lab to lab. And they put stripes down on the floor in the big warehouse so that the robot could move around. One time, I saw the robot accidentally trip over there was a broom that somebody had left in the hallway. And the robot started making this horrendous screeching noise and, you know, a loud klaxon went off. And, oh my gosh, it was something out of a sci-fi movie. It was so funny. And I thought all it took to trip up this robot was a little stick in its way. So, you know, it looked advanced, but...
There's a meme going around where people are defeating self-driving cars in San Francisco as a form of rebellion against them. People are defeating them by placing a single traffic cone on the hood of the car, and that just paralyzes them because, like, all the cameras and everything just see a traffic cone in the middle of its space that shouldn't be there, and so it stops. I don't think we have to worry about the robot uprising just yet, but we'll keep an eye on that.
That would actually be quite amusing, though, as a sort of a plot device. Foiling the robot attack by placing strategic cones.
John Connor arms the resistance with traffic cones.
I did actually have a chance to see. I'm trying to think what it was. It was one of the big dog era Boston Dynamics robots. I got a little tour of one of the labs, and they're pretty cool. it was pretty neat to see the thing, in person in front of you. But it is a they're very loud, or at least they were at that point.
They are very loud. Yeah, they are very loud. They still are. Yeah, I actually recently heard an interview with a Boston Dynamics engineer, and it was super interesting. And one of the things he said was that the YouTube videos are amazing, but of course they show the success. And some of those early robots that went viral on YouTube, the video was the one time in 10 that it actually worked the way it was supposed to and did the right thing. They're better now, but they're still only like 80% of the time work correctly, which is still, way too low. And that curve is asymptotic. So to get to a robot that can climb the stairs 100% of the time is just orders of magnitude harder than 99%. And 99% is not good enough. You know, that's 1% of the time. If it falls down the stairs, that's unusable in any kind of real world application. So they're kind of climbing that steep part of the curve now, and that's going to be tough.
Okay, let's see. What else? So apart from Shaky, we had Forth was also came to be.
Implemented Forth was.
Exactly.
That was a joke. I appreciated that joke I did.
I don't know that much about Forth. I read up on it for this, but I never really seriously tried to program in it. but it was apparently, well, I know a little bit about the history of it. There was a radio telescope, National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and Charles Moore, who had sort of like been designing this personal programming language for a while, had implemented some of the like sort of operation software in his own sort of personal language forth. And then there was someone else, Conklin, who was finding this kind of hard to maintain, and so hired Elizabeth Rather. These are the three people who ultimately founded Forth Inc. But Elizabeth Rather was horrified to see that there's this telescope was being operated by software that was not documented and existed only in the head of one person. And so she sort of set out to document it. And then this, you know, she basically found that, they didn't have the budget to rewrite it in Fortran. So she was just trying to like document what they had. And she found that she was turning out to be super productive in this language. Like it turned out to work really well for the kinds of things that she wanted to do. And so essentially, you know, they started promoting it. So they started Forth Inc. and tried to look for commercial applications of it. And that was the beginning of it. So, and this was basically 1970. I think 1973 was when Forth Inc. actually got founded.
I'll be really careful when you say Forth Inc., this Forth Inc. computer. The thing I mostly know about Forth is stuff to do with its name. That it was always spelled in all caps at the beginning, even though it's not an acronym. Right. And that it's Forth, F-O-R-T-H, not because, you know, tally Forth, but right. Because it was like labeled, it was the fourth generation of things, but the operating system was on, could only use five-letter file names or whatever. So they just spelled it F-O-R-T-H because of that. And so that's, it's just basically a misspelling.
Yeah.
I did not know any of that. That is hilarious. I've always actually really liked Forth. I mean, I really love reverse Polish notation. I've always used HP calculators, and my brain just really likes working that way. So the language appeals to me. But what I love about Forth is that it's a very logical, high level, getting your foot in the high level language door after like macro assembly. It's sort of, it maps pretty much one to one to macro assembly. So it's a very straightforward way to get a high-level language going on a machine without having to spend, you know, 6 years writing a compiler or whatever. You can just implement a language like Forth pretty straightforwardly. It's pretty much straight translation. You don't have to do a lot of compiling. And because of that, it's also very fast because it's pretty close to the structure of the hardware. It's close to the assembly language that's generated from it. And so it makes a lot of sense on older systems and small systems, for sure. Mm-hmm.
People have joked, though, that Forth is a write-only language because trying to look at some Forth code can be a little daunting, especially if you're not used to working in that sort of bottom-up reverse method that it uses.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. I would compare it as a modern equivalent to Perl. Perl is very similar in that when you're writing it and you're in the flow and you're in the zone, it makes perfect sense. And then you try to read someone else's Perl or Perl that you wrote 6 months ago, and it's just gibberish. It's just like, yeah, it makes no sense. It does have that issue.
So if you want to listen to a dusty podcast on this, also this person named Retrobits did a two-part episode on this back in 2009. I was just looking that up today. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first started to get interested in Forth. I'd heard a lot about it, hadn't played with it. So I did a deep dive on it and found that I really liked it. But that said, I really haven't found a practical use for it, even in retro playing around. It's, you know, other than just messing with it and learning how to use it, I haven't found anything that I would want to write in it. I tried, I think it was for one of the retro challenges, I tried writing a game in Forth, and I think I actually got, and it was just a text-based game. It wasn't anything with graphics or whatever, but I got a little ways into that. Did I actually finish it? I can't remember, but it's a curiosity. I like it. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the lack of libraries for graphics and things kind of held it back as ever being much more than like a scientific slash industrial process control language, which I think is kind of where it found its sweet spot for a while in the late 70s, early 80s. There was an Apple II version called Graphorth. I never used it. I don't know if the name means it had support for graphics primitives or something. Does anyone know?
Yeah, I think it did. Isn't Maxwell from Maxwell this little human? Yes, I think so. It is Forth, but with graphics capability.
Okay. I actually have a copy of it in my collection. Mm-hmm. I got it, but, you know, I was 12 and I was like, this is dumb. Where's Choplifter?
Yeah.
So as an adult now, I'm like, actually, I should go play with that because I like Forth and I have a copy of it.
Yeah.
Maybe Earl will make a version of Choplifter.
So 4AM says in our comments that Graphforth does have a fairly extensive graphics library.
Oh, well, there you go.
Oh, and on the stream here, we have the reference manual for it, which I don't have because mine was a legitimate right. backup. Or a distributed backup, as someone recently described it.
Yeah, this was it wasn't published by Apple. This is another company that made it. As 4AM notes,
it looks like it though. Like it looked that the manual is very much an Apple's style of the time, which is kind of amusing.
Yeah, this is it's actually written by Paul Lutus, who also did Apple Writer and Electric Duet. Oh. So it's kind of a collectible thing on its own, but I do remember having it float around when I was young and using the Apple II. Also, the Jupiter Ace is a computer that was sort of like natively Forth. I think it's one of the few.
Look at that keyboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
In all its chiclet glory.
That just screams miserable to type on.
We'll show you for buying our product.
I think Atari had a couple of versions of Forth also. And the C64 had one that I really like called Blazing Forth. And I think it had some libraries built in for things like sound and graphics. It's been a long time ago, though. I couldn't swear to it.
Mm-hmm. With this Wikipedia page open at the moment, I don't like this thing it does where it says, like, discontinued 1984, 39 years ago. Like, stop telling me how old I am.
Right. Another thing, this came up in our own little chats separately in the Discord, but I just a couple of days ago I got in the mail a wiki reader, which I think we have talked about on the show like long time ago, but it's like a little square device, little small LCD device that basically you put Wikipedia articles on an SD card and then you can read them with this. It has a little virtual keyboard, and so even if the internet goes down and you're out in the woods and you need to look up, you know, facts about the wiki reader, you can do it. But the point that is relevant here is that it actually has a Forth interpreter, so you can write Forth code on it, and there's a calculator program written in Forth that as a demo there. So I haven't opened mine yet. I have it. It's in a very nice box, and I will open it and play with it. But there are only actually two other things that that I had notes for on 1970. Although certainly many other things must have happened. The first of them is Conway's Game of Life, which we have all heard of. And I went to Wikipedia to search, or Google to search. I mean, I went to Google to search, and I, you know, typed in Conway's Game of Life, and it does give me a list of links, but then it also like runs Life in the background. It's pretty cool.
That is amazing. Wow. I had no idea. That is a great Easter egg.
So
well played, anonymous Google right. engineer.
But yeah, so I guess, my understanding of this is that it only Conway himself, John Conway, did not publish this in any meaningful way, but it was published as part of a Scientific American, like, you know, mathematical games sort of article by Martin Gardner. So that was October 1970, and that's what puts it in this year.
And destined to become an assignment on first-year computer science classes for the rest of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing that feels like, you know, it's substantial enough that you've done something.
Yeah, it's just enough work. It makes a good assignment, and the result is fun to watch, and it's a little bit of a test of various concepts and so on.
this may a neuron connected with another neuron in my brain, and I don't know if it was appropriate for it to have done so. But
look at me, I've got two neurons.
That's right. But so when I was writing this game for the Apple III, actually I've written a couple of these, and one of the things I absolutely did not want to do is spend any time designing levels or any of this other stuff. So I you know, immediately said, all right, this is all going to be procedurally generated. You know, there's going to be random numbers, you know, it's going to be a river and the river's going to wiggle randomly or whatever. But life is, you know, it kind of works that same sort of way. It's like you get some sort of like, appreciable art. You can see stuff, you know, neat that's happening, but it all happens automatically, algorithmically. So once you've got this simple program down, then just lay out the blocks, and it just goes. So
then the dinosaurs break out of the pen and everybody dies, and
could.
That's what we call emergent behavior, and those are always fun to write. My favorite in that genre was always flocking algorithms. If you look up like Boyd's, same thing. You've got a very simple three rules that you can implement on AI agents, and they will create this incredibly realistic flocking behavior that birds and fish do. And it's super satisfying, and it's that same thing where it's like the code is really easy to write. It doesn't take very long, but the result is amazing. So it's fun to do that sort of thing.
Okay, I think we're just about done with 1970, right? The last thing that I didn't even put this link in here, but I think it's probably correct. October 1970, the Intel 1103.
I don't know that there's that much to say about it other than DRAM was introduced in 1970. It's been like the predominant kind of random access memory that we've used since. So kind of important.
I didn't know that was 1970. That's a really big deal. The big deal, of course, with it was that it was cheap, because static RAM was very, very expensive and very much limited the growth of computers, especially home computers. You know, even with DRAM, I mean, the price of it, like an Apple II, was like 60% was the RAM, and that's why they were also limited so early on. But DRAM made it all possible, at least. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I think the Apple I used static RAM. But that was one of the tricks of the Apple II, was they could use dynamic RAM, but only by sort of like tying it into the video in this funny way so that it would refresh, you know, whatever it is, 60 times a second.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you don't know a lot about electronics and you read about dynamic RAM, that you have to read the entire contents out and write it back in every, you know, millisecond, or it loses its memory. You think, that's the dumbest thing. That can't possibly, how would you ever use that? Like, that's a terrible invention, but turns out it's pretty great if you know how to use it. But it is a hassle. Like, nobody, like, lots of people build homebrew computers these days, and nobody uses dynamic RAM because it is such a hassle. And static RAM is cheap in small quantities still. So, yeah, it's a huge hassle for sure.
Oh, all right. Let's see. So I guess that'll do for 1970. And join us next time for 1971. And now I guess we can move on to... So I have been a little behind in editing and also in collecting a listener feedback, so I had actually been not planning on touching listener feedback until I got a chance to go back and look at it. But just moments before we started recording, one came in. So that one I noticed. So this was Tron DD wrote over email about the Aquarius Plus. So there was a presentation by, I think it's Sean Harrington at VCF Midwest, about the current state of the Aquarius project. And that's actually quite worth watching. Let me actually move over to it.
So this is a modern project, like an Aquarius II modern thing?
So, so in this talk, the Sean Harrington talks about, kind of like the original Aquarius project and like the ways in which it, you know, was and was not a failed project. I mean, there's a story about how it, I don't know, it cost Mattel a huge amount of money. They had to sell it back to who is it, Ratafin, someone like that, and who ran it into the ground, and but whatever. So he's kind of trying to rehabilitate the Aquarius as being actually a fairly cool computer once you sort of give it enough memory and things like that. And there is a modern project called the Aquarius Plus. So that's part of what is discussed in the talk. So I think it's an FPGA project. It lives in its own little case, but it remains compatible with the cartridges and the peripherals and things, and looks interesting. So if you have ever wondered about the Aquarius, watch the video, and you might be convinced that it is not horrible. Because that's the thing that often people say, is that, you know, it's kind of cool as a novelty, but it's unusable. It has a terrible keyboard and no memory and all that stuff, but it does look nice.
Didn't last time we talked about the Aquarius, didn't we decide that it was basically an Intellivision internally? Kind of like how the Atom was basically a ColecoVision?
That seems possible. I mean, that seems familiar and it seems possible, but it's a Z80 machine.
So this version is got a bunch of upgrades, though, but it remains backward compatible. Is that the idea?
I haven't looked at it too carefully because, as I say, it came in just minutes before we started recording. But I hadn't heard about this project, and I have an Aquarius and a bunch of the, you know, peripherals, like there's a modem and a tape drive and a printer. And, you know, it all looks like a nice set. I would like to set it up at some point, but I just have yet to really play with it. And I'm not sure that this would inspire me to, but at least watching the video rehabilitating its image might help inspire me to use my original one.
Christopher in the comments says the Aquarius was not as advanced as the Intellivision, so it may have been a subset of it, but it was not as good.
There apparently was an Aquarius 2, a very, very short-lived thing, and I have, I think maybe one went by, like I didn't see it, but I think maybe one went by on eBay in like living memory. Yeah, it would be, I've always kind of wanted to see/get one. Here's the Mattel Aquarius 2.
I had no idea that existed. Maybe that wasn't in television then. Maybe the Aquarius 2 was.
Yeah. Anyway, yes, I will not read the page, but I do know that if I ever see one of those, I will immediately buy it, unless it's unreasonably expensive, which it probably will be. So now I guess we can turn to items of interest in news. Carrington has the first of these.
I do. I wonder what it is. Oh, it's this. Okay, so there's a thing called QMU. At least I pronounce it that way rather than QMU, which is a virtualizer. It's an emulation thing. It's free. It's on GitHub. And it's mostly used to do virtual machines. But I came across just a couple weeks ago, though it's existed for a while, I only recently learned about it, this thing called UTM, which is like an easy graphical front end to that. And why you might be interested is if you wanted to run a PowerPC Mac emulator on a modern Mac, this is a crazy bonkers easy way to do it. Like two clicks, you're running. And I was really surprised how easily this works. So it's so like official and that there's a version on the Mac App Store that you can purchase, although it's download. But you can pay $13 or whatever it is to get it from the Mac App Store. But you can just download this application. It's all signed. And then go to the gallery and pick a thing, a virtual machine that you would like to run. And lots of these, you know, if you want to run Windows, whatever. The problem is on the Windows side, you're not going to be able to run games because it doesn't really emulate anything that's going to give you decent graphics. But if you wanted to emulate a computer that already was crappy at games, never had to work around, then the Mac OS is perfect for that. And this is a little difficult to, if you wanted to do a Mac OS 9 emulation on a modern Mac with Apple Silicon. This works by, like, you download it and then click open in UTM and you're done. Like, there is no step three. It's crazy. I got this working today in 40 seconds. Once you click open UTM, it literally just appears here and you just click run and it's running. The thing that was tricky for me to figure out was this bit here. It's hard to get stuff into this. There's no copy and paste. You can't drag it over whatever, but you easily can just pick something here to mount I've just clicked on it and I said, I'm going to say mount. You can't see it, but I'm mounting the Mist ISO. I just downloaded Mist to see. And literally it's just in real time. Like you just download and click and go. And because I linked the Mist ISO, it just now appears here. So it's an easy way to get stuff in. You can do regular disk images, whatever. I should be able to just play Mist. My memory is Mist has to run from a hard drive, though. A long time since I've run Mist. Let's see what happens when I double-click Mist. Yes, go to 256. Let's see what that does to StreamYard. but literally, that's it. I'm now playing Mist in an emulated PowerPC in 9.2. It's bonkers fast and easy. It's a little fiddly to get things in and out, but if you just want to play some PowerPC games from the macOS 7, 8, or 9 era, this is three clicks and you're done, and then just download an illegal copy of a game and link the ISO, and you're playing it. So, like, it's cool. I really dig this thing. I think it's surprisingly easy to use and surprisingly robust. I was able to mount the 9.22 upgrade image and just upgrade it and worked seamlessly. I tried a few things from OS or from System 6. They're absolutely unplayable. Everything's so fast. It's just not a chance. You got to do the System 7 thing so that the timing is done that way. But it is like if you're a modern Mac and you want to emulate a less modern Mac or do Windows other than gaming, it's really cool. It's really slick. So
I dig. Yeah. I have used it. I wonder what I have installed, but I installed that and have been fairly happy with it.
Like I mostly use other emulators. Like I like Baskless too. I like Mini VMac and stuff, but sometimes somebody just might want to say, I don't want to go through any fiddly stuff. I literally just want to go to a website and click open. And then I just want to like link to a game or something. Like it's remarkably easy. So you want to just dip your toe in emulation.
Well, I think it's actually also one of the only, I mean, obviously you could use whatever it is, Qemu, however you pronounce it.
Right, yeah, but that's really hard to configure. I tried that once before and I failed utterly. I didn't get it to work at all. So.
Yeah, so this is a good way in. But I was going to say it's one of the only ways to do Intel.
Oh, right. Okay, yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So, like, for things that no longer run on M1, yeah.
Links to all the legal bits in the show notes. The rest is available through Google.
Right. Cool.
Just one quick comment on QEMU, or however you're supposed to say it.
Quemu.
I don't know either.
I think it's a GIF.
But I did.
The M is silent.
Actually, in the 90s, I used, among other computing systems, I was into Spark stations. So QEMU will emulate those and run SunOS, Solaris. So I was able to talk, and it did take quite the incantation to get it to do it, but I was able to talk QEMU into running the old Solaris. So that was very fun to see it. And then I deleted it because that I just wanted to see it again and walk through that kind of squarish GUI that it had. What was the name of that? Somebody in the chat probably knows. There was a standard common desktop environment that you had on HP, and I think IBM had it, and maybe a couple of other manufacturers. And so you could actually go from Unix box to Unix box and see a common GUI. And it was just pretty fun seeing that again. And QEMU can do it.
Is it possible that it was CDE or Open Windows?
CDE. Mm. That was it.
Excellent.
Well done, chat.
Yep. Specifically R2. Yes. All right, Earl, I guess you have the next thing as well.
So I just thought that this was exciting, that there's a YouTube channel I love called Adrian's Digital Basement. There's actually a couple of channels that Adrian has, and he posted a video recently that he's been able to completely disconnect from his corporate job and become a content creator full-time, which is neat. Applause for Adrian. I think that's great. So a couple of interesting things. I don't want to ruin it. I think people should go watch the video. We'll have a link for it. But I had two takeaways from it. One was there are things to consider and life adjustments to be made if your hobby becomes your job. And that's one of the things that Adrian was finding was, you know, he was doing his channel and working his full-time job, and he had all of his, the life balance all figured out. And now all of a sudden you don't have the full-time job anymore. And it's so like, when do I do my videos now? Do I do them in the day? Do I do them at night? You know, that kind of thing. And also he's going to keep the cadence of videos that he's been putting out, not increase it so that he doesn't burn out, because he really loves what he's doing. The second thing that I thought was interesting was that it wasn't just the YouTube monetization that enabled this. It was a combination of YouTube and Patreon. And I know that quite a few retro content creators have a Patreon and people give them a little bit of money every month. But if enough people do that, the money adds up. And then you're able to at least defer a little of the cost of the hobby in a lot of their cases. But in a small number of cases, you're able to just, you know, go off and be a content creator full time. So I thought that was fun.
Yeah. It's always sort of interesting when there are enough people interested in this to make that possible. I think he has a pretty big YouTube channel. So I mean, I can see where that would like as opposed to ours.
Let me see, Adrian's, because I think it's something like it's over 100,000 subscribers, mm-hmm. which I think is one of the benchmarks. The 189,000 subscribers. So yes, I think just, you know, a little bit bigger than our channel.
Yeah. All right. So one thing that I discovered just quite a short time before we started recording was that Tezza Stewart is back. So he's recording new videos for his old computers in his collection.
Yep. That's very exciting. Great. I didn't know that. Great.
Yeah. So there were I think the most recent of the not recent batch was like 7 years ago. And then in the last month he's posted it's got to be like a dozen. So there's the PCXT, PCAT, the QX10. There's a whole lot of stuff that I can't load and show you, but nevertheless, I promise you it's there. His videos were, they're always, you know, thorough and informative, and you get a really good view of like what it's like to use the thing and what it's like inside. And so I am glad that they're back.
Agreed.
I think I'll leave that there and move to Quinn. You have the next thing.
Okay, so I'm going to devote my entire segment. I've got three separate links that will all be in the show notes, but I'm going to devote my entire segment to a machine that I've learned about fairly recently and have become mildly obsessed with, and that is the IBM ThinkPad 701C. People will know this as the famous butterfly keyboard laptop.
Ah, that one, right.
And... yeah, and I heard about this thing and thought, how can that possibly work? And so I have, for the benefit of the stream, I have a very short video here that just shows how it works, because that's what most people want to see about this thing. If you haven't heard of this laptop, it has a keyboard that is wider than the laptop, and when you close the laptop, the keyboard folds in on itself to be a smaller size. And it's absolutely bonkers how this works. The keyboard kind of folds... in the horizontal plane, half of the keyboard shifts up and over and kind of in a checkerboard fashion interlocks with the other half, in thus forming a narrower profile. It's really quite amazing. I'm not sure what the date on this thing was, maybe late 90s, something like that. That segues into the next part of my little speech, which is that looking for videos of this thing opening and closing, I also found this guy who is I appreciate nerdliness in all forms, and this is the narrower and deeper the better as far as I'm concerned, and this is the narrowest and deepest nerdliness that I've come across in quite a while. This one fellow is so obsessed with the IBM ThinkPad 701C that he has devoted not only an entire website to it, He has a blog all about restoring them. He remakes parts for them. He wrote an iFixit guide for them. He's, as I said, manufacturing replacement parts for them. He will sell you new screws for them that are the right color. He has an extensive YouTube channel all about restoring them. He has restored dozens of them single-handedly. He's got a video that I will also link to in the show notes of a complete restoration from start to finish of one of these machines. And yeah, it's fantastic. So if you have any interest in this machine at all, go ahead and check out this blog. It's a good starting point for all things IBM ThinkPad 701Z. And in particular, his restoration video is quite a good watch as well if you like retro computer restorations. The mechanism in this thing is really fascinating, and in his restoration video, you get a deep dive on how it works, because it is sort of a crazy mechanical thing that it does when this keyboard folds up, and it's hard to appreciate it without seeing the mechanism internally. So that's basically it. That's my news item.
Do we know what year that laptop was introduced? What era is it from?
No. I don't know what year it's from.
And also, I wonder how many are left in the wild.
Yeah, I don't think very many. I imagine the mechanism is fragile just by looking at what it does.
Well, according to Wikipedia, the 701's got released March 6, 1995, discontinued December 21st, 1995.
Wow.
What's the C?
Okay, so...
Wow.
So maybe not a lot of them made then, by the sounds of it.
1995, it looks like.
Yeah.
At least that's when InfoWorld reviewed it. And that is just a fascinating method to get a bigger keyboard inside a smaller laptop. Although I imagine the laptop had to be thicker because of the way that keyboard comes up and folds over itself.
Yeah, it's thicker because there's like some armatures underneath that create the sliding action, and it's also deeper because the keyboard has to physically, half of it has to move up and in, so it takes more depth when folded up than a normal keyboard does. So yeah, they definitely paid a price in size for it, but it's certainly emblematic of, people probably remember that the early 90s, those early laptops, people were really struggling to find ways to make them smaller but still have good keyboards. That was because the keyboard was really the limiting factor on size in many ways. And so remember, people were doing things like 3/4 sized keys and or more limited keys, eliminating keys, having as few keys, making the keys slightly smaller, making the keys closer together. People were trying everything. So this was a very bold experiment. And well, what if we put a full size keyboard in and just make it fold itself up? And the fact that it works by the action of closing the lid is pretty fantastic.
Though it still feels to me like, adding a failure point, somewhat gratuitously.
Oh, big time.
I mean, it reminds me a little bit of like the cars with the headlights that come up. It's like, why would you do this?
I was doing the exact same thing back then. Yes. You're going to drive around with your one blinky light up.
Yeah. Mine never worked. I had a 68 Cougar, and those little flip covers in the front, I always just had to open them up manually. Never worked right.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Anyway, but interesting indeed that they made it. So what did we decide it was like 9 months old?
It's absolutely one of the iconic laptops.
Okay, I had one other thing that I guess I might as well just... mention, which I don't think this is actually new, but it is something that I only came across today, which is the Wi-Fi Retro Modem V3. And what it is basically a little card that you can put inside the case of Hayes smart modem box. So what it does is provides a Wi-Fi, but it has all the lights, and the V3 will actually play the dialing sounds. So that
kind of cool.
Yeah,
I love the look.
That's pretty cool.
That's speaking of iconic industrial design, like boy howdy, I know this. I can just imagine holding this thing.
Yeah, it would be and I'm near certain that I have one somewhere, but
we're all pretty sure you have one, Paul.
Yeah, I don't think I intentionally got one, but they sort of come with, you know, other things that you get. If you were to go follow the link that is in the show notes, you can see the sort of internals of it. And basically you just unscrew it, take out the original guts, put in the new guts, and there it is.
What do you do with it though? So what do you mean it gives you Wi-Fi?
Oh, it's a Wi-Fi modem. So the idea is that communicates over the modem port, but you can type stuff like ATDT IP address, and it will play fictitious sounds, and then it will connect to you. Yeah, there is a video somewhere of it playing, and I don't think I can send the audio through. But I mean, it seriously sounds like touch tone, dial tone. You know, it does the horrible carrier, everything you want.
There was a time where I could listen to that and I would know what speed I connected at.
Yeah.
Early enough days, I could tell. Yeah.
Yeah, you could hear the negotiation between the two ends, which was cool. Yeah. And as they got more and more advanced, like when you got onto the 28.8s and the 56Ks and stuff, the negotiation got longer and longer and longer because it had to, like, do you have compression? What kind of compression do you have? And there was all these different questions going back and forth. So it got quite long.
Yeah.
It was a whole song.
Yeah, for sure. And it was like, I have very fond memories of those noises, like, because it was like victory, right? Because you've been redialing for 3 hours to get into your favorite BBS or ISP. So when you heard that noise, it was just, yeah, you were just like, yeah, it was such a good feeling.
I think this is like 10 years ago, somebody made a spectrogram visualization of the negotiation sounds. So you can, and it's actually really quite interesting to listen to this at the same time that you're seeing the spectrogram, because it's totally, it's all familiar. You can you probably almost can hear it looking at this thing going by. But
so are the peaks there the different frequency ranges, and you're seeing what's happening like on certain ranges of hertz or kilohertz or whatever?
Yeah, I think so. So like the sort of, I don't know what the width of it is, different frequency ranges and so different frequency, you know, settings. And so the amplitude, I guess, is the height. And so you can sort of see the harmonizing that it does when you see the several spikes like there. You know, you can see that it's a couple different frequencies at once. But yeah, once it got to be about, well, like 19.2, I maybe could just about
it's
still
a complete
do it. But
heart
after
transplant.
That, like anything above 19.2, I don't know.
Hayes smart what modems. It was, and I wonder if people with broken Hayes smart modems are wondering why
do people
want
that.
These now?
I knew this was 96.
Because I wanted to go out and find a Hayes smart modem for parts and put one of these in there, because I just think this is the coolest thing. I could never afford a Hayes actual modem. I always had to get a clone. Did any of you all have an actual Hayes?
I had a pretty sure I had a clone.
No, I had clones as well, because, yeah, there were a lot of clones of them that looked very much the same. But, yeah, that look is certainly iconic. I think this is a fantastic idea. I would love to do this to it.
Yeah.
And mostly, like, when something exists where you're going to gut a vintage thing, I'm always like, oh, you shouldn't gut, like, but, like, modems are useless now. Get away. What are you going to do
totally.
With that thing?
This is...
Right.
Yeah, it's a sweet spot for gutting old things, even if they work, because yeah, they're all literal boat anchors. Like they don't even work even if you have a landline, because landlines are all VoIP now, so they could not be more useful.
Plus, I think it's a reversible change. I actually watched a video on how you take the old circuitry out and put the new in, and I don't think it requires that you break the old circuitry. So you could put that in a static bag somewhere. And...
Yeah. What if we want to break?
What if you're like just you're still employed by U.S. Robotics and you're like, no, I'm going to destroy all the Hayes ones.
Yeah. U.S. Robotics. Yes, I had several of their modems. Their little
That's a brand new modem I did have. USR.
I had a USR also. Yeah. The Hayes modems are one of those things where like now we can all get them because now they're cheap. But none of us had them in the day because they were super expensive.
Yeah, and even so it's kind of a it fun hurt thing. More that I sold them. We had them at my retail store. I just couldn't afford one, even with the employee discount. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bought one of the X2. When the X2 modems came out, I always had to be the fastest kid on the block on modems. So I went out and I bought one of those, and I went looking around for an ISP. And I found one. There was only one in town, I think, at the time that supported that speed. And they were like, oh, you want to use that? Well, neat, because we've got it. And then the next thing I knew, US Robotics was contacting me and saying, hey, would you like to be in a press release? Because, you know, not that many people are using these. So I said, sure. I can probably dig it up. I actually, they quoted some pithy quote that I gave them or something like that. You know how they do.
That's kind of fun.
They totally. Were fast, though. Oh, my gosh. They were stinking
Is that what
fast.
They quoted? Oh, my gosh, Earl Evans. Near Portland.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my gosh, they were stinking fast. Earl Evans, modem user.
What was the fastest modem you guys used on a BBS before going to internet stuff?
Not 56K. I think my 1200 baud, I think, or something. Maybe 96. Oh, no. I think probably 1200s on BBSs before I think.
I had a 14.4. That was the fastest I ever got before.
I had a 14.4. Yeah, it must have been that then. Right.
Yeah, that was kind of the 16-bit era of BBSs. Yeah. It was kind of the 9600, 14.4, 28.8. 14.4 was pretty sweet for downloading because I went from 2400 to 14.4. So that was just jump. Game-changing.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at all the wares.
And then internet stuff for... Yeah, totally. Oh, I was wares and I was distributed backing up at a furious pace. But after that, I went to the 660 AV Mac, which had the GeoPort. And so faster modems were a software upgrade,
yeah,
which was
crazy, right?
Bananas. It was such a cool thing.
Yeah.
Such a cool thing.
Yeah, the exact same experience. I was like, what the heck is this, man?
The GeoPort is one of those like lost to time Apple technologies that
yep, unheralded.
Few people will ever appreciate, yeah.
Like CyberDog. OpenDoc, bring it back. I'm bringing it back, man.
Sherlock.
Yeah, I'm not bringing it back.
Well, they're bringing back the Aquarius. That's something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of neat.
I saw one of those. Remember when you could actually find retro computers at thrift stores?
Oh,
those were the
days.
So passing up an Aquarius for 10 bucks is one of my regrets. Because it was sitting there, I was like, I'm already accumulating too many of these things because they were dirt cheap or your friends gave them to you or whatever. And I kind of wish now that I would have bought it and played around with it because it looked cool.
Sure. I've had a similar retro computer experience. You forget like how old some things are that they're now retro. If you go on Mac Sales, you know, the MacSales.com, I don't know what they're called. Everybody knows them by another name. It's a big online Mac. That you can buy like 2010 or 2011 Mac Minis that are pretty tricked out for $39. And I'm like, well, that's, we're getting down into like Raspberry Pi pricing now. I'll just get like a computer
that's
got
that's
an
really
i3
cheap.
In it and 8 gigs of RAM. And it's just like, that kind of stuff, that era has now gotten bonkers cheap.
They max out at one of the big cats, though, don't they, in terms of the OS X?
Yeah.
I think you can't put, like, the latest OS X on them.
Sure, but I wouldn't want to.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. So, yeah, I've got a $100 Mac Mini running my MAME cabinet, and it's maxed out at Snow Leopard, I think. But that's kind of perfect because that's, you don't want anything newer than that anyway. Like, you want to be pre-64-bit apocalypse, first of all, and then anything newer is kind of unnecessary, like if you're not going to be upgrading or installing new stuff on it. So it's, I haven't touched it in like 6 years or something since I built it.
And that's kind of what you want, is to set it up and not have it want to change or update anything.
Exactly. It still works perfectly. It has no internet connection. Like I do not let it connect to the internet. So it doesn't, nothing tries to update itself or anything. And then it just stays working and it's been flawless as a MAME cabinet. So yeah, those Mac Minis are useful things. I'm doing similar things with like emulating games now because I got a bunch of old 32-bit, older Mac games that I really like that got cut off by the 64-bit apocalypse. So I've got an old PowerBook like that isn't worth anything, but I just keep it on like an older OS X so that it can still run all those older games that got locked out.
All right. So I think we have made it to the end of the items of interest in news, and now a word from our sponsor.
20 years ago, I helped invent the personal computer. I knew then that it would revolutionize the desktop. Today, thanks to high-speed modems, it's revolutionizing the world.
Now you can download nearly twice as fast with new X2 technology from U.S. Robotics, the world's number one selling modem.
Now I don't have one computer on my desk. I have millions.
This is a Hayes modem. Plug it into ordinary phone lines, and you can send financial projections to the PC down the hall. Or locate a single part anywhere across the country. Make airline reservations. Send or receive electronic mail. Or access millions of pages of data, from company profiles to every fact in the encyclopedia. The Hayes modem. It's like sending your PC to college for under $600.
My parents have showed me how to get streaming video over the internet.
My dad showed me this cool real-time radio station online.
Matt, what's the matter?
It's my parents. They still have a 28.8 modem.
U.S. Robotics 56K modem download at incredible speeds, so you can finally unlock the true power of the internet.
Hey, we were all 28.8 users once.
The U.S. Robotics 56K modem from Freecom. Buy one now and get $50 cash back.
And we're back. So let's see. The retro computing gift idea this time is an interesting book that I think it was actually just recently published, called EORFF, and it's by David Yod. You can buy it on Lulu as a self-published thing, but he's also put it on archive.org. So if you want to just if you don't want the physical copy, you can just read it. Publication date, September 13th. So that was 2 days ago as we record. But it's a really interesting concept. It is, and so it seems like it might be a good gift to someone who appreciates the 6502 at a deep level. It's written as a bunch of he's calling them ponderables, or little code snippets in 6502 that do something. And so the first one is they're numbered, so number 00 in the category of 6502. It says EOR immediate value 1 branch of equal some other label, and so you were supposed to look at this and think, what is significant about this? What is happening here? And there's a bunch of these, a one is another little set of instructions, all in basically 6502 assembler. And so the way you play the game is to just read them and try to figure out what's going on. If you give up, there is a little thing at the end that sort of tells you what the idea was supposed to be. So for that very first one, I will spoil. It says this performs an equality check without using compare. So unlike using compare, it leaves the carry flag alone. So it's sort of, there would be a reason to do a comparison with using that. What was it again? EOR, I guess. Rather than actually using the compare instruction, because whatever it could, both you could reverse it with a second EOR and you leave the carry alone. So, and the book's full of this stuff, and it might actually be nice to have as a paperback, just to sort of idly sit, and look at and maybe write little notes on it. So I anticipate learning. So
this is
a tricks.
Poetry book for computers. You just sit
kind of
with your jug of wine and you ponder your 6502.
Yeah.
Or like puzzles, sort of like 6502 mm-hmm. puzzles, figure out what this is doing and why it's interesting kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is neat. It's a good idea for a book.
And it's not exclusively, it's 6502, so it covers a lot of, the computers of our age range. Right. But so some are specifically, some are just 6502, some are actually specifically particular computers. So this Hex 12 is for the Atari 8-bit and Commodore 64. And I guess that's because it makes use of a particular IO address that does something. So I am interested to read this. I have not really gotten very far into it, but I really like the concept. So that is the gift idea for this time. Okay, and so I guess once you're done pondering 6502 code, you can turn your attention to eBay, and Carrington has some things that he is going to try to convince me to buy.
I do indeed. I'm going to try to get you to buy dust covers. Small expense unless you get the best of them. This is my first choice. And this is the one that caught my eye and got me thinking about dust covers. I think this is quite a beautiful dust cover. It's a modern thing. It's being made now. And I love that it's got, like, it's made of cotton. And so I think of dust covers, like, the oldies being like these ugly vinyl things you put on. I love, this looks a little more luxurious to me. And I love the little embroidered Apple logo. I think this is fantastic. I think it's just a really nice looking thing. It's available for all the Toaster Macs. So you pick which Mac you have, like a Classic or an SE or an SE30 or whatever, and also which model keyboard you're pairing with that. There isn't a corresponding little mouse cover, but I think it's just gorgeous. Downside is a bit pricey, but it's a handmade thing. So it's basically $115 US. So I love it. I love it. I think it's the prettiest looking dust cover I've seen for a Classic Mac. If I had a Classic Mac on a desk, I would totally pull the trigger on this. I think they're great. I also picked dust covers that don't cost $1 billion. And sort of like, it's kind of like this is an Apple versus the rest of the world thing. It's, oh, look, dust covers for the 64. It's $27 US. So it's like, welcome to the Apple tax. These are also it says it's cotton canvas. It doesn't look as luxurious. It's made out of like individual pieces that have just been sewn together with this piping. So they're not as nice, but it's absolutely the dust cover for the masses because it shrinks the cost down, consider knocks $100 off or whatever. So considerably less. And the same person has them available for a bunch of different products. So you can get the Victorian, you get a 500, you kind of pick your model. And I thought that was neat. But most interestingly, I think, so they'll do Commodore 64, VIC-20, like all these various things, Atari computers, all from the same person, who also makes one for the Amstrad, which is the only one that has no label at all. So if you've got an Amstrad and you're ashamed of it, this is the dust cover for you. I don't know why the Amstrad doesn't get a label, but it's the only one that does it. It makes me want it the most of all. So shameful Amstrads. But also Ataris and Commodores all can get a red piped dust cover. Dust covers for everybody.
I wonder if it would fit over the Sam Coupe.
Well, that doesn't exist. So Paul, if you have a Classic Mac and you want a luxurious dust cover, or if you have a shameful Amstrad, I think the whole range of computers, all of your computers can get dust covers now. So this is my pitch to dust covers for Paul.
Yep.
Can I order the Commodore one with a different logo on it? Because I would like to keep the dust off my Commodore. I don't necessarily want people to know I have one. So,
oh, well, that's the Amstrad approach. I wonder if you could pay extra.
Amstrad might fit.
It's just, yeah. If I could order the Commodore one with an Apple logo on it, then I'd feel pretty good about that.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be pretty funny. So anyway, that's my choice. All dust covers all the time. But I like the Apple one the best.
So Curtis in the chat points out that Amstrad users are too busy using their computers, so they don't need dust covers.
Yeah,
that's right.
I see.
Yeah.
Fair play.
And Jay in the chat also suggested that the Mac cover that's on the screen right now is what Christo's Mac would have looked like. The visual artist who drapes things over things.
You get one too many sad Macs, so you just like put the cover over it and walk away.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's right. It's a punishment.
It also looks a bit like the NanoRaptor, one of those NanoRaptor designs, like the ultimate simplification of a Mac product. It's just a white block with no input or output of any form on it.
Right.
It's the Johnny Ive dream.
Yeah, I really do. I got to say, though, I really do like the Mac one. I think it's like, if I was going to get a dust cover, 100% I would pull the trigger on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, just aesthetically, I think this would look lovely on display.
Though I wonder, I mean, like, if you're covering up your keyboard and computer because there's dust and you cover it with a cloth thing, then all the dust then goes on the cloth thing. So
or it's more about how pretty it looks.
Sort of, yeah.
Oh, but you can wash the cloth thing, which is, yeah. I think, yeah. the idea. And then it doesn't accumulate in your keyboard and the yeah. vents on your monitor and such.
Yeah.
You're an Apple user. You're supposed to just keep buying them.
That's right. Just buy it and a couple of spares.
Right. Also, if you think about it, this is expensive if you've got a classic Mac and a dust cover, but it's cheaper if you want to pretend to have a classic Mac. You just kind right. of set up this on your desk and you're good. As far as you know, I have an SE30.
All right. Earl, you have the next in this themed set of items.
Indeed. So this is a very interesting dust cover. It's for a bread bin, like a Commodore 64 or VIC-20, and it only covers the keyboard. It's made of hard plastic, that kind of dark, translucent plastic that you might have seen back in the 80s as something like a printer stand. And it looks, this is the thing that was so fascinating to me, it looks like it has a little hinge, or somehow it's able to fold up and then act like an easel. It acts like kind of a, you know, a music holder for your musical keyboard or something like that. So you could put instruction manuals or something that you're typing in or whatever up on the easel and have it there for quick reference while you're keying it in, I guess, or using your software. But it wasn't clear to me how this attaches to the computer. I didn't know if it required some adhesive to, you know, whether it glues to the top of the bread bin, or whether it just, when it sits up, there's some way that it hooks itself in to like the dust vents or, sorry, not the dust vents, the ventilation holes. Mm-hmm. I don't know how this thing attaches. And I wasn't able to figure it out by looking at the eBay auction. But so that's kind of partly why it's fascinating to me. I'd be really curious how this works.
The box says something about it that includes two angular feet. What does that say in the front there?
Let's see.
Angular feet. To...
Yeah, two attachable feet to change angle of keyboard for comfortable positioning.
Or maybe they'll go underneath and it's actually going to change. Yeah,
how does that work, though?
Yeah.
It really wasn't clear from the photos. And this is, I think, yep. new in the box. So the person didn't actually take it out and show photos of it, which is probably fine. The styling of the box, by the way, is very reminiscent of the styling of Commodore boxes from the day. So if you were buying Commodore equipment, this would look just like it, all except for the brand logo.
Mm-hmm.
And how much was this going for? By the way, was it $30?
$30.
I like this thing a lot, actually. I think it's neat. I mean, back in the day, this would have been immensely useful because you were always typing things in from magazines or typing things in from printouts or whatever. I think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And or if you have a cat, walks over it and it's not going to be able to press the keys. You got it.
Yeah, totally.
Some people have shop cats.
Right.
Yeah, cat proofing.
Oh, you know, actually, I have one of these. One of the actual things.
Of course you do.
Yeah. Let's see.
Just the one.
How does it attach?
Well, that's what I'm... Let's see. I don't know if I can tell how it attaches. I mean, it looks kind of the same.
That's a photo of yours?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. My guess is an adhesive strip or something.
Yeah, it looks like it's...
That's a hinge.
Some kind of anchor here.
Yeah.
Yeah, those might be screws.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, okay, maybe just drill it straight into it. What's the worst that can happen? I love it.
But I think this is, it does say Computer Mate, so I think this is the actual thing that we were looking at.
That looks like the same one.
Yeah, it looks suspiciously like you had to drill some holes in the case maybe to mount it, but
yeah,
really neat though. I like it.
Interesting. And you know, I think it does actually look relatively classy when it's closed.
Yeah, so. I like it.
Oh, Tron DD in the chat says it's a stick-on.
Oh, okay, cool. That's probably better. I don't know.
Less fun.
Probably.
Just drill it down and open.
I'm just imagining that those adhesive strips from the 80s are not as adhesive as they used to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even when it was new, that probably limited the amount of weight that you could put on the easel. Like if you put a big math textbook or something on there, I'm guessing they would just pull the adhesive off.
The VIC-20 Programmer's Reference Guide just knocked that thing right over.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it did stick, it would just tip the whole computer over. It's not like the VIC-20 weighs 10 pounds.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, the machines weren't that heavy.
Yeah.
As soon as you lift your hands off the keyboard, it just flips.
All right. I have a completely random set of things, but so it goes. Here we go. So the first one is a Tandy 200, which I think I have brought these up before. It's like the Model 100, except in something like a laptop form. So it's got a big screen instead of a little screen, and it's got actually a pretty nice keyboard, like the Model 100 does. They yellow in a sort of a weird way, but this is the end of the line, like the newest iteration of this form, and looks okay. The thing I wanted, and it comes with the modem as well. So what does it say? Powers on to a black screen, selling for parts as is. So that's what we can see here in one of these, that when it's powered on, it's just showing just all dark pixels. And so you might say, well, okay, then like the cable's not connected to the screen, or the processor's not starting or something, or yeah. I think this is, so it's not selling for very much. Its starting bid is $100, which isn't that much for these. But I think it might be, so I guess I wanted to point this out because I think it might just be that if you may have to replace the internal battery, but if you charge the internal battery, I think that will bring it back to life. So it might be a fairly easy fix. This person doesn't know much about it, and I only know like a little bit about it, but I think that it is likely to be workable. It may not require much serious repair. So if you're interested in the Model 100 world, I mean, like this is sort of a luxurious way to get into it. Anyone have any experience with these?
No, I've never seen these.
It does also, did you mention, it's got those cool phone receiver cups for the acoustic coupler.
Yep. And I think these will, you know, they're just sort of generic across this line, so they would work for a 102 or a 100 as well. But and I think there's also, I think this other cable is the is like a cassette controller. So
I like that the acoustic modem is just the rubber cups, like it doesn't have the base that they used to have. So this is like the ultimate in portability for when that acoustic coupler modem is just a little too big. This is like two separate pieces.
Mm. And it doesn't need to be a particular size phone either. So,
right.
So that was one of the random things. This, I don't know, this caught my attention. So this is an old Strategic Software Inc. game, Computer Napoleonics.
Strategic Simulations Incorporated, SSI.
And this is a particularly old game. So, I mean, it's interesting just because it is quite rare. I mean, this, like, they were not much of a powerhouse at this point. And it's actually in quite good shape for what it is. And it is starting at a bid of $20, which is why I thought this was kind of remarkable. And the reason it caught my attention is because I had one. I don't anymore, but it was much more beat up. So I took photos of it and put it on the Internet Archive, and you know, so like it's preserved already in this sense, but the one that was on eBay actually looks a lot nicer than this. And as I recall, I sold this for kind of a lot. So even in this beat up state.
So it's weird, both yours and the one at eBay auctions, the back of the box is just plain white. They didn't do any printing or anything.
Yep.
It's, you don't see a lot of computer things where there's like nothing back there.
It was just a box. But anyway, so if you happen to be looking for this, I think the person who's selling it knows that this might go for a lot eventually because they've set it at a long auction. But the starting bid is, it's ridiculously low. So
you can kind of date it just by the fact that the title has the word computer in it. Like it was from that era when everything was like, it was Computer Battleship and Computer Poker and whatever,
right,
as they were naming games that way, because I guess you had to specify that software was for a computer. It just made it feel high tech or whatever, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, if I'm not mistaken, SSI's first game was Computer Bismarck, which was, in fact, the game Bismarck on a computer.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's why, because, yeah, they were porting paper and card games, so it made sense to put the word computer in front of it to qualify it.
I always wanted one of these SSI games because it wasn't just the software. It came with a cool map or a diagram or, you know, some things that went along with the game that helped you play.
Well, it had to because the graphics on screen are so terrible.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the idea of various simulations that they put out were, that was also interesting too. Never did wind up owning one back in the day, but they always look cool.
They all look like the same game.
Yeah, there are so many of them, and they are really all variants of the same program. Well, I mean, there's maybe like five programs, and they're all variants
of one. Because it comes from that 70s tabletop wargaming era where those games all look the same, like, you know, Squad Leader and those types of games where it was a big sheet of cardboard and with little pieces of cardboard all over it with little numbers, and it was all supposed to be tanks and such. Mm-hmm. And that's a very intense and dedicated community that plays those games to this day. And so these were, computer adaptations of those games. But SSI is an interesting company, though, because they had two main eras. They had this war game porting era, and then later they got the Dungeons and Dragons license out of nowhere, which shocked the entire industry that they even bid on it, and then that they got it. And so then they had this whole era of making these Dungeons and Dragons games later that I think more of us probably played than these early war games.
Yeah,
it's weird. I think of SSI as being the company that has all the computer things, but I most associate them with Pooleradians. Like, so it's, yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it's funny that the same company made Computer Napoleonics and Advanced Dungeons and Dragons Pooleradians.
Yeah. The next thing I have is a Radio Shack acoustic coupler in a box. I thought it was kind of neat just to see the box.
I think I had that modem.
Probably.
Yeah.
300 baud. Also 110 if you need 110.
Half or full duplex, because sometimes,
you never know.
Yeah, 100% I had this modem.
It's neat to see the box. But yeah, I think this was the standard acoustic modem for all the Radio Shack machines. Yeah, and other people seem to think it's cool too, because it's reached a bid of basically $51. So
might be as much for a box.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were just talking about how useful modems
are.
That's
so useful modem.
This one probably even more so.
They kind of need to turn it into like a Bluetooth speaker or whatever. Just like out of the little couplings comes music.
Yeah.
Again, I advocate for gutting all modems apparently.
Yeah. I think I talked about this one. Oh, this has already gotten some bids since I put it down. But this is a super early Apple software package. It was like business software that they sold called the Controller. And what's kind of cool about this is it's got the actual box. It's got all the discs. It's got the binder that it comes in. And so it's neat because you could, like, one of the things I would want to do with this is recreate the photos from their marketing, you know. But yeah, anyway, it's a nice instance of it. And I just thought it was interestingly complete and was not selling for very much initially, but and had the box. I think that's...
So I have a question. I don't know if it's a Canadian thing or not. So Controller, is that the same as a comptroller? This is position-wise. I mean, why is there no P in that?
I have no idea. I don't know why it's called that. I mean, I think the word comptroller exists here too. So I don't think it's trying to be comptroller.
Okay.
But I don't know. Maybe you are controlling your business destiny.
No, I'm not.
Look at all that stuff. Look, they've got all like the forms and the checks.
You can totally play business.
Yeah, I guess if people are wondering what this is, it's a huge array of software programs, and there's general ledger, accounts receivable, there's an invoice generator, and basically every business function appears to be represented here as a piece of software in this giant collection of disks that I guess all kind of fit together. It's sort of like a Microsoft Office, but for the actual mechanics of running the business. Yeah. So this, I suppose, would have been quite the cool thing in the day. I bet this was expensive. This feels like something that was expensive at the time.
Yeah, probably.
I wonder if somebody bidding on it is because they've got some really old accounting stuff that they have been desperate in the middle of a lawsuit. And they're like, oh my God, I've got to get this.
This one, I didn't buy this. I'm not sure that will remain true. But so we've talked a bit, I think, in the past about the BBC Micro, you know, Model B. That was a big thing in the UK. And there was a little bit of an attempt to, you know, introduce it to the North American market. And I, when I was a kid, took one of these home from my North American school over the summer once to play with it, because we had one.
Oh, I remember you talking about that. Yeah.
And I'd never seen one since. And finally, yesterday, I was just, you know, for some reason looking on eBay, and there is one that says, so the title of it says Rare 110 Volt American Acorn BBC. So it does say on the power supply, if you get close enough to it, somewhere there's a picture of it that gets close enough to it. It does say 110 volts. And if you go to the description, it says it's a 110 volt power supply, cannot be used with a UK 240 volt supply. It will blow up. So,
but it says it has a UK plug fitted to it.
Yeah. So that's the thing that I found strange. So now we're looking at a picture of the back of it. It does say 110 volt on the thing by the plug, but the plug is a UK plug. You know, it doesn't plug into a North American thing. So at first I was like, well, maybe they extrapolated very far from seeing a 110 on there and said, well, maybe this is a North American model. But it turns out that after they tried to sell these in the US and failed, they shipped them back to the UK and then sort of reconfigured them again for the UK. So this one on eBay seems to be sort of like half reconfigured. Like it's at least it says it's still a 110 power supply, but it has a UK plug on it. But it is actually one of the US ones. So it has one of the things you can see on the back panel here is it has an FCC ID and a UL listing. So that's you know, North American.
I was literally about to see. I guess they look for the part 15 of the FCC. It'll have to have had that sticker on the outside.
Yeah. So I think that alone convinces me that this really was one of the North American ones.
Does that mean it has NTSC video as well then?
That I really don't know.
Because like, is it just 110, but you still have to have a PAL monitor or something? I wonder how that works.
It's potentially a very weird mix of things. But the serial number does have it's like UNB09 or whatever. That's the thing that indicates the model that went to the US. One of the things about these North American models is they have there's a kind of like a local area network system that they had optionally, but the North American ones had this Econet kind of on all of them. And there's one thing that's not good about it, which it has a crack. But otherwise it looks to be one of these sort of like later ones that was in fact sent to the US and then sent back. But I don't know about the video. I think I probably would have, if I were to get this, I would be using some kind of video solution anyway that would convert it to something else. But it has like composite out and also some kind of RGB out that you can, I think, connect to a SCART connection. So I don't know. Anyway, I don't know if it's PAL or NTSC.
Very cool.
What. Yeah.
That is super rare.
That's a neat thing. I don't think I realized there was ever an American BBC micro version. That's really neat.
Yeah.
Because they were good machines. Like, they had good graphics, and they were really capable of a lot.
And it would be such a pain to try to operate one here. Like, just get a UK it one would, and bring it over. Oh, my gosh. Like, so this solves a whole bunch of that problem.
Mm. Yeah.
Someday, specifically even for just the nostalgia of it, I would like to have another one of these in front of me.
Well, if somebody else buys it, you can borrow it for the summer.
Right. That's
maximum nostalgia.
Exactly. Yeah, there really probably aren't all that many people in the U.S. that have, like, physically typed on these in the 80s.
Yeah, I've never seen one to this day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never seen one.
They're large. Okay, anyway, let's see. What other things did I want to talk about? There is a working Apple Interactive television box.
What's that?
Yeah, so...
What?
So, okay, so it does sound like people are not familiar with this.
I am completely not familiar with this.
So this is... this was designed... I think it was designed for something like a hotels... where you'd put it in, it'd be sort of like the thing that you watch movies on or whatever. And I think they actually deployed these very briefly at some like Disneyland property or something like that. But what it is inside is something like a Quadra or something like that. It's a Mac inside that boots off a network. And so the thing about these things is that you rarely can get them to do anything because it's unclear what video, what the video out situation is. And it when the network's not there, it can't actually boot. So I think for a long time, they were basically just dead. I have one, looks just like this, I think it also does the little green, power light and looks just like shows static on the screen. Yeah. Right. But I mean, it looks neat, but it really doesn't seem to do anything. And I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, someone did figure something out that allows people to get a little further. And I'm pretty sure actually Tony Diaz had one that he managed to get, sort of like acting like a real Mac. But so in this listing, there is a video showing this thing actually starting up, and I had never seen anything close to this. So you type in some sort of code and it goes out to the network to try to figure out, what's supposed to be loaded in and things. But there's actually like something showing on the screen, which is further than I've ever seen one of these go. And I think that they're different. I mean, I think some of them have different ROMs from other ones, and it's all kind of almost a prototype situation. But at any rate, this one seems like if you really wanted to experiment with this and have some hope of actually getting it to do something, this one might be the one to do it with, which is probably why they are asking $680 for it. But so that's a lot. But at the same time, I've never seen one work like this before.
How much is known about the server side of it? Was it also just a Mac of some sort that was the server, like there'd be one in the hotel or something?
That I do not know. Probably. I mean, yeah, but I think it needs to be like reverse engineered what it was supposed to be pulling down.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, there's probably some server software out there somewhere that one would need. I wonder if that still exists anywhere. I wouldn't be surprised if Tony Diaz had it. Mm-hmm.
The funny thing is that I think in Apple internal documentation, they referred to this as the AITB, the Apple Interactive Television Box. I mean, it seems like such a goofy name for it. But anyway, yeah. So I'm now sort of re-interested in trying to figure out if it's possible to get mine to do anything, because I mean, it's mostly been just a decorative lump.
The networking is almost certainly Apple Talk. So I wonder if you just set up a standard like Apple Talk NetBoot setup and plugged it in, if it would just boot off of that somehow and maybe start doing something. Like maybe it's just a standard Mac NetBoot that it's doing.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem actually had been getting the video, getting it to display anything over video. So once you can sort of see what you're doing, then that helps a lot.
Yeah, it probably doesn't show any video until it's booted. So because you wouldn't want to, like if it's in a hotel room and the power goes out, you want them to all just quietly reboot and come back up to a menu of some sort without showing like macOS booting or whatever. You don't want to show all that. So it probably intentionally keeps the screen black until it gets to the first menu.
Yeah.
obviously makes it incredibly difficult to diagnose what it's doing. There might be some kind of a debug mode on it or something, like you can flip a switch inside or something, like a dip switch to show all video or something.
Yeah, I guess they didn't open this one. But it really just, you know, it kind of just looks like a Mac inside. It does have a ADB port on the side so that you can plug in like a keyboard and mouse.
It might behave differently if there's a keyboard plugged in. Like maybe it boots in some sort of diagnostic mode when a keyboard is plugged in.
Yeah, could be.
Because the guy was demoing it in the video with a keyboard connected. So I wonder if that's because he was going through some sort of diagnostic menu there. It looked like where it was detecting a tone and it was like being assigned an ID number on the network and various things. So that makes me think that just plugging in a keyboard might wake it up.
Yeah, it looks like reading about it online, the hard drive that comes with it comes with at least parts of the regular system 711 and a finder, but then some network socket things and an MPEG-1 decoder.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I think actually that was what the one of the things that happened, you know, in the not super recent but not super distant past was someone found the like the system enabler or whatever that would that you needed to make this thing go. So someone had it on some disk somewhere, I guess, but because that's a lot of the Macs of this era needed some little extension to let the operating system communicate with it. Okay. Anyway, that's enough of that, I think. Was there anything else that I really wanted to talk about? I don't know. Oh, I guess I thought this was interesting. So this is somebody who's selling a iMac VGA vented cover. So it looks like this. Is this familiar to you as an object?
Isn't that the back cover of an iMac, like where the handle is?
Yeah, sort of. So
is this so that you can get video out or video into it and use it as a TV or something?
So the iMac normally has a cover that covers a VGA port. So like there is a VGA port there, but you don't have access to it.
No, I had no idea.
I didn't know that either.
That's such an Apple thing to do.
Yeah. And so what you can do is you can you can replace the cover that covers that port with a cover that has a hole in it. So you can get to the port. It is one of the more ridiculous ways to expand your iMac to have VGA, given that it already had it, but now you can just reveal it. So I guess that's the thing I thought was funny about it, was just the very fact that this piece is needed to gain access to a port that was already there.
Hilarious.
Yeah. And this one is brand new, so if you want a brand new one of those.
Well, everything that's old is new again. The story went around in the news recently that HP has started putting covers over the USB ports on their printers. But the port is still there because they didn't want to re-engineer the printers to take out the ports. That would have been too disruptive to the manufacturing chain, but they want everyone to print over Wi-Fi because then they can control it. They can force you to log in and use their registered ink and stuff. So they just put a plastic cover over the port. But you can still use it over USB and bypass all their stupid DRM and stuff.
Excellent. Okay, I think nothing else that I can see here is super important. I guess, yeah, I'll leave it. I'll leave mine at that. And Quinn, did you have any eBay auctions you wanted to do?
I do not. I have not been on eBay lately.
Okay.
There's lots of dust covers.
I'm staying off it since, yeah. Well, I'm actually, you got me looking at dust covers. I was doing a bit of eBay searching for dust covers while we were talking. I would like to find one for my 2GS because I want to keep the dust out of the monitor on that one, but I wasn't able to find any. I think I might just make some though, because I mean, a computer dust cover is just about the easiest sewing project one can do. It's literally just a cube, so.
Or just a blanket.
Yeah. Yes. Or yeah, just a blanket. But I do like the idea. It's one of those things where I think dust covers are more useful now than they were in the day, because in the day you just used it enough that it didn't need to be covered. But nowadays, I mean, I use my retro machines once every couple of months, so it's not a terrible idea to keep them covered in the meantime.
I was actually thinking about that earlier when I chose the dust covers for the eBay auction. And this is the kind of idea that only Lane Nooney could figure out. But I wonder if there's something to the idea that like dust covers were around forever, like pre-computers, like typewriters, especially manual typewriters. And then we get computers, and everyone put dust covers on them. And then at some point, was there an intersection between everyone stopped using dust covers because there were now screensavers? And so now your computer was this interesting thing you want to watch.
Oh, I see.
And I wonder if that killed the dust cover market.
So if you can sort of squint through the dust on your screen, you can see interesting screensavers.
Right. Well, just because if you're going to invest in, you're going to have your Toaster Max, or your flying toasters or whatever, you're not going to want to throw a dust cover over it.
Or it could be a clear one.
Could be a clear one, yes. Yeah. It's called a window.
Yes.
My house is my dust cover.
I shall not want. Yeah, I was. Yeah.
You broke me.
Sorry. Yeah, when we were looking at the dust covers, I thought, well, like when we had an old gift idea, which was a comforter, and I thought, you know, that'd be another way that you could do it. It's just like cover the whole like side of your room with the whatever Hello comforter.
I like that.
Yep. I don't know how long ago. This was years ago, a gift idea that we had.
I don't remember that. I want it. I probably wanted it back then. I still want it.
You probably suggested it.
May have. Didn't buy it. But I still want it. I prefer to want than to actually get.
Right. So I guess we are actually at the point of closing discussions. Carrington, what would you want to tell us?
I want, I got nothing, but do you know retro things? I got nothing. I'm still laughing at that joke. What do I got? Nothing. I'm an empty void. I cease to exist between shows.
Yep.
I sit here. I just close the little display and I just wait. I sit in silence.
All right. Let's be honest, not in silence.
No.
You've never had more than 7 seconds of silence in your life.
Gotta fill the void. Gotta fill the hole of my life with noise.
Okay. Earl, any closing notes? You've written some things down.
Yeah, a couple things. One is I want to help people out with bingo. So I've got a little tell and show. And since it's an audio podcast, it's more like tell and imagine. So I'll try and paint a word picture here. What I'm holding, something about the size of an Atari cartridge, but out of one side of it is poking an Atari SIO port. And so what this is a FujiNet, if I can hold it in the camera here. And this helps with bingo, because Carrington already said Sam Coupe, so we just need Nabu and Kay Savitz. There you go. So I got a FujiNet from Moswell.com, ordered it, and it shipped out, I think, the same day. It got to me like crazy quick. And I popped it onto the Atari 800. First thing I did, actually, was load up the Plato client and connect to that modern-day implementation of Errata Online, which was amazingly fun. And then loaded up some disks, put an SD card. This thing can actually run CPM, believe it or not. It's got a CPM emulation mode among all the other 10,000 things that it does. So I put some CPM software on the SD card and ran it, and that was fun too. But that's not the main thing I wanted to talk about. Now I'm holding up a PCB that has two giant connectors on it. And the purpose of this PCB is just to connect this one giant square connector to this other giant, and maybe, Quinn, keep me honest here, is this a DB or a DE
connector? I'm not sure. So the E is the shell size, so that would be something else. That's like a G or an F, maybe. Like, that's enormous. I've never seen one that big.
Connector. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is like, I think, 37 pins. So I had to solder this yesterday. I had to make like, 72,000 solder connections on it. But its purpose is to connect a modern day implementation of an Altair disk controller called FTC Plus to some disk drive. And it is very flexible. So no pun intended. Because you can use this controller to connect to modern day-ish 5 1/4 inch high density drives or to actual Altair drives, of which, and this is where I strain my back.
Oh boy, I shouldn't have done this.
Okay, you can tell by the strain in my voice that I'm holding something very heavy. This is an Altair 8-inch disk drive. And
wow.
I'm going to put it down before I die. Sorry.
Did you just say sorry to the drive? Honorary Canadian.
Yeah.
Actually, sorry that I was so far away from the microphone. Maybe that's a good thing. But that drive looks kind of like an Altair. It's the same case manufacturer, I'm pretty sure, the Optimus cases. It had the nice dress front panel and the blue around the edges, and it is a giant drive.
It had the MITS logo, I saw.
And the MITS logo, and for storing not very much data per floppy disk, but I think it works.
It stores a datum.
Yeah, one datum, exactly.
Just the one.
I don't know if it works because I've never hooked it up, but now that I soldered this little connector together, I can try hooking it up. But the other thing that I needed were, I needed some floppy disks. And believe it or not, at floppydisk.com, you can still buy 8-inch, single-sided, single-density, hard-sectored diskettes.
Wow.
New in box. They're new old stock, but I've bought disks from them before, and the disks arrived and work like a charm, look, just like it's like the 70s and 80s. So those are en route to me and will arrive, I think, tomorrow. So the question is, okay, I have no operating system. I'm going to have blank diskettes. How do I bootstrap this? How do I get an operating system so that I can then boot the operating system and use the operating system to make more diskettes? It's kind of like the chicken and egg sort of scenario, that something like, oh man, why can I think of that Apple II program that is so cool that helps you solve that?
Well, ADT Pro.
Yeah, ADT Pro.
Yeah. ADT Pro for the Altair.
Yeah.
That's what you need. Yeah. So with ADT Pro, obviously, you can load a little bootstrap program onto your Apple that it can feed it through the, almost like player piano mode. And then that software will then let you move over floppy disk images, and then from there you're golden. The Altair does actually have something similar. There is a program that you can load through your machine language monitor that will then let you copy over a floppy disk image. And then once you've got a floppy disk image with CPM, then there are programs from there that you can use to copy more floppy disks and yada yada. But, you got to get there somehow. So this is the beginning of the saga. I'm hoping this is going to work. I don't know for sure that it's going to work, but I think so. So maybe next time when we get together, I can let you guys know if there was any success here.
That's exciting. I've never seen an actual Altair 8-inch floppy drive working outside
neither.
Of, was it War Games, or which movie was it that had that?
Oh, those were IMSI.
Yeah.
Those are IMSI. Okay.
But they're fairly rare, and go for stupid eBay prices when you can find them on eBay. But I just want to see it work. When I opened it up, the outside of the case is a little rough. No scratches in that, but it's pretty dusty, dirty. I have to try and figure out how to clean it up without removing any of the original finish, because you don't want to mess up the case by trying to fix it. But when I opened it up, the inside is pristine. It looked like it just came off the assembly line.
Or they had a multimeter.
It had dust cover, exactly. I used the multimeter to check for shorts to make sure that no tantalum capacitors were ready to get me. and everything was okay there, so I powered it up, and it powers up. I just don't know if it's going to do anything, so I'll let you guys know.
That's neat.
That's it. That's all I got.
Very cool. Exciting, though. Yeah. Let's see. Me. I have... I'm continuing to sort of try to compress my office from two big rooms into one room. And that's interesting because it means that I see a lot of these things. I'm trying to arrange stuff so that the stuff I actually want to get to sooner is closer to the front.
It's nice to just be able to see the stuff that you have, too.
Yeah. No, I think often kind of startled by, like, the coolness of some of these things that I'd forgotten that I had. But, someday I really do want to get to them. But, so we'll see if I do. But another thing that I got, I haven't not done anything with it, but I have an Apple Squeezer, which is a 2GS accelerator thing, which I... So they were very hard to get. They sold out immediately, and there was just a new run recently, and so I jumped on the email that said, they're available. So I'm looking forward to putting that in. I have a Transwarp GS accelerator in there right now, and the problem with that is that it's real old tech that... could fail in a way that this probably will be less likely to fail. I think it's mostly compatible and runs faster than the Transwarp does and so forth. So anyway, I know almost nothing about it, but I'm kind of excited to try it. So I don't know, Quinn, have you heard about or used one of these?
Yeah, so I just missed my chance to beat you to the punch on that, actually. So,
oh, sorry.
Because I also had one coming in. I ordered one from Nick, and unfortunately, mine got lost in the mail from the Netherlands. They're coming a long way, and we waited, I don't know, a couple or 3 months, and it just never appeared. And then both of us talked to our respective post offices, and I think we've determined that it never made it out of the Netherlands. It seems to have vanished on their end. But he's sending me another one. So he was super cool about that and just sent me another one. So it's on its way now, but I am also looking forward to receiving that. You are correct. It is a modern 2GS accelerator. I believe it goes to 20 megahertz. The Transwarp GS, which is kind of the de facto GS accelerator, is 7 megahertz. So pretty huge difference. Hmm. I think the one compromise the Apple Squeezer has is it does not support 5.25-inch floppy disks. I believe it does not know how to slow itself down to talk to those. So I think you have to not use your 5.25s. But other than that, I believe it's basically compatible with everything. It's sort of like semi work in progress, I think. Like, it's not quite a beta, but it's, it's a new product and he's working a few things out. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of experimental, I guess. But pretty cool to see a 2GS running that fast, I imagine. So I'm looking forward to giving that a try as well.
Yeah, I think it provides RAM too, I believe. So
yeah, it's got a bunch of stuff that it does. Yeah, it's got RAM in it, and I think some other stuff too. It's when you look at the website, it's just like, oh, this is sort of does all kinds of things. Yeah. So I'm excited to play with it.
And I think you can just turn it off. Like, if it's supposed to be possible, at least, to just kind of like make it invisible, and
right.
Then you can use your drives and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah, the one thing that I will miss if I end up sticking with it is the Transwarp GS boot up sequence, which is one of the best things to happen to computing in the history of computing. If anyone hasn't seen it, every single time you turn on a GS with a Transwarp in it, it does this like swooping fly-in of the logo with this like THX style sound beat thing, this whooshing, There you go. This incredibly dramatic sound effect, and it made me happy every single time I turned on that machine for the entire decade that I used it. You can turn it off in the settings because I imagine some people got tired of watching that, but I never shut it off because I loved it so much.
Mm-hmm.
So I would miss that for sure. If he can somehow make the Apple Squeezer do that, then I'm sold.
Yeah. That's... It's a little bit like the theme song for a TV show.
Yes.
Which, so sometimes, a lot of times people will have, even in TV shows of the old past, they would have a cold open where, you jump into the action and then only eventually do you get to the theme song. But I actually kind of like having the theme song right at the beginning. It's like, all right, I'm getting into the mental space to enjoy this show. It's about to start, which is something that cold open ruins.
Yeah, I liken it very much to the THX. What did they call it? They had a trademarked name for that, the Deep Note or something they called it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Where the logo would come up in the movie theater and it would play that crazy bass note that was their signature sound. And yeah, it very much got you excited and put you in the mood to watch this movie with this amazing sound system. Yeah, and the Transwarp had that same effect on me, for sure.
Yeah. There is a, on the THX website, there is a page devoted to the Deep Note.
Oh, did I get the name right? That's
yeah.
I'm actually a little bit mad at my brain for using up space with that information, but okay, great.
They have a score, if you want.
Yeah, there was a whole team that like developed that too. Like they spent 6 months.
They have a score for a note. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah,
I know it's a whole thing, but
I think the reason I know this is some podcast talked about it. So this idea of having a signature noise. It started with either THX and or HBO, and now it's a thing, right? You start Netflix and it plays that sound. You start Amazon Prime, it plays that sound. Mm-hmm. It became a branding thing. They kind of invented this idea of a brand sound, and so now everybody has to do it. But yeah. Transwarp beat them all, so just saying.
Yeah.
Take that, THX.
And actually, we might as well continue on with your closing discussions as well.
Yeah, that's about it. I'm waiting for the apple squeezer. Not a whole lot else going on right now. I did a real big push on my 2GS game there for a while, but then life got in the way again. So I haven't worked on it since we recorded last, but same status there as before. I'm close and I really want to finish it. I think, I don't know, 50 or 60 more hours away from something that I would be comfortable calling a playable beta, first playable kind of thing that I could actually send to people and get some feedback on. So that's my current goal. And then I have other projects that I really want to start, not until I finish that. So.
Yeah, I do like that strategy of forbidding yourself to start something new until the old thing is finished. But yeah.
Yeah. I would never finish anything if I didn't force myself to do that method. Cause yeah, the motivation always goes away right near the end of the project. So I wouldn't finish it if I didn't. Use the excitement of the next thing to drive myself forward.
Right. All right. Well, I guess we made it through the 1970 episode. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find also lo-fi episodes for playing on your retro machine and more via Gopher at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at forum.vcfed.org something. You can follow RCR on Mastodon. We are at rcrpodcast at podcasts.social. You can join our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. You might write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time...
Retro compute.
I'm very pleased that I got it all the way through my retro compute before anyone else started.
Yeah. Problem is, we keep waiting longer and longer for the queue. Yeah.
Until next time.
Yep.
Who's going to go first? It's like a game of chicken.
Oh, there's a question in the chat about my record player. Mm-hmm. It is not a Grundig. It's a. Apollo by Electrohome. They're made in Canada, made right here in Ontario, back in the 60s and 70s.
It is very cool looking.
I also have a Canadian record player. Mine is a modern one, though. It's by Fluence, which is a Canadian hi-fi maker.
It's a fancy brand.
They're nice. They're actually super reasonably priced. I have their home theater system and their turntable, and they're shockingly reasonably priced and beautifully made. Really, really nice.
Yeah, totally, totally great stuff.
Go Canada.
Mine is finicky, but I love it. Love it. Love it so much. It's one of my dearest possessions. One of my seven possessions. So I have a big stack of Blu-rays behind me at the moment.
When you got that turntable, I looked them up and they are crazy rare. Like, I don't know how you found that thing.
Person locally just put it on like Kijiji. And I was like, oh, I've wanted that for forever. Yes, please. Yeah. Like, I was holding out for this for so long. I couldn't. And I didn't have to do anything but change the needle. Like, works perfectly. Wow. Radio, the record player, all it's the stacker. I can put up a whole bunch of records and they drop one at a time and play the one side.
That's so amazing.
Love it so much. Yeah. So it's just
what a cool thing.
I adore it. I listen to it constantly. And I put a, the only thing I've changed on it, I plugged into it a phono to Bluetooth adapter, which has a little battery, which is great though. But then I can just have headphones on from anywhere, but listen to my record player cranked up, which is nice.
So born analog and then transmitted digitally.
Exactly. You got all crackles take, and all.
Yeah, you take that rich analog sound and then mangle it with terrible Bluetooth compression.
Yeah, well, I'm in a condo, so you can only crank things. I don't want to be the neighbors, right? So sometimes you want to like listen to it loud. So it's for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like the globe speakers on bass, yeah.
Having the little automatic dropping system is good for like albums that have multiple discs so that you can listen to all the odd sides and then listen to all the even sides.
Well, there were a bunch of things that actually got, if you look for them in the, especially early records and things that were like audiobooks or old time radio, it would actually be like record one was like side one and the back of it is side seven or whatever. And so they were designed to go in a row and then you turn the stack over and listen to them that way.
You just blew my mind with that. I have a multi-record set that is like that, and I didn't understand why. The sides are numbered in a weird order. I didn't understand why.
So you could stick them on a record set.
That's stacker. Okay. Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah, I think it's a Led Zeppelin album or something. It's like a two-disc set, but it's four sides that are numbered in a weird order.
That would be the reason. Yeah.
Cool. All right, now I know.
Yeah. In fact, it's quite possible that they're numbered in such a way that you could take the whole stack and flip it and have it continue.
Yeah, that's how they were.
That's
back
what he's saying. Yeah.
I've got an Ella Fitzgerald thing that is eight records and it's a whole, but it's interviews and stuff and it's designed to put them all on and then reverse them. Oh, no, sorry, four records, but eight sides and you reverse them all.
Probably also for jukeboxes because they would be similar, I guess. Yeah. There were stacker jukeboxes that worked that way too. Yeah. Cool.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's probably good enough for now.
Sorry, YouTube. Yeah. We went off on a tangent there because we're still live. That happens around here.
But I think we already did the closing. So, all right. Thanks everyone for sticking around for 2.5 hours or whatever this was. And soon things will be on the feed and we'll be back here probably in a couple weeks. So.
Retro compute.
Yeah.
That was for the next show. I came in that early.
Excellent. All right.